I'm going to share with you some thoughts about creation science. I'll introduce myself again for those who weren't here earlier. My name is Patrick Briney, and I'm from Mission Boulevard Baptist Church, so I bring greetings. And I was here at the founding of this church many, many years ago. In fact, I don't remember what year it was. But I was new in the faith and just gotten into the church at Mission Boulevard Baptist Church. And I know that the church organized here with a group of hippies. That's how it was back in the 70s. It was hippies. And we had a group of hippies who were playing songs at the co-op, food co-op. Is that still around, Brother Terry? It is. So anyway, it started in the driveway there. And then Brother Tom Harden came out. And now you got Brother Kenny Hicks, who's been pastoring for some time. And you guys got a special heart, a special place in our heart at Mission Boulevard Baptist Church and in my heart. Really great to see everybody and glad to be here. This morning I introduced myself, gave some stories, and what I want to do right now is just kick off with Romans chapter 1, and there's a lot of material to cover. We're not going to cover it all, but as I'm moving along through the evidences for creation science, if I get into use a word or a thought or something that doesn't quite make sense, just raise your hand. We want to clarify it. I don't want you to have to hang on to it until the end. Then you'll forget, and then I'll leave, and you'll think, "Boy, I wish I had remembered to ask that question." So just ask as we're moving along. I'm used to it. I've been teaching on the college campuses for 40 years, over 40 years, and been in all sorts of crowds, so you're welcome to just raise your hand, ask any question you want. If I don't know the answer, we'll work on it. Creationinsights.org, if you want to find out more information that I'm talking about tonight, or this morning. if you want to find more information, you can go to my website, creationinsights.org. It lays out the three main areas of arguments: origin of the universe, origin of life, origin of species. And those are the three most important things I say in a lecture like this. The reason for that, you have to understand your topics. If you understand the topics you're dealing with, then you understand the questions that need to be asked and the evidences that you're looking for. I asked earlier how many have heard a creation science and evolution debate. Oftentimes it leaves people in confusion. The reason for that is because the evolutionists argue this way and the creationists argue this way and they never meet. And there's a reason for that. It's because they're not addressing the same topics. You got the origin of the universe, it has its own set of arguments. You got the origin of life, has its own set of arguments. Origin of species has its own set of arguments. And so you got to keep those separate. Otherwise, you're going to hear something like, first and second laws of thermodynamics support the creation science model. Yeah, but living organisms are not a closed system. Now, you have two problems with that, but the most important is, one is arguing for the supernatural origin of the universe, and the rebuttal that I just gave is arguing for or against the creation science argument. It's arguing on speciation. Those are two different arguments, two different topics altogether. They don't belong together, and that confuses people. So that's why I like to separate that out and make sure people understand what arguments we're actually dealing with. If you look down here in Romans chapter 1, verse 20, it says, "For the invisible things of Him, that is of God, from the creation of the world are clearly seen, Now, from the creation of the world, since God created right up to this time and beyond, there is evidence that there is a supernatural hand upon this place. There's intelligent design. There's evidence for that. God's got his fingerprints all over this thing. Like you would expect if you looked at a painting by Michelangelo or anybody else. They're painting. Somebody painted this wall. I've been noticing that too, and it's been here for some time. But you know, this came out of somebody's mind. This is a product of someone's imagination here, and then they put it up on the wall. But God had an idea for creation, that everything exists as it is, and it's got his fingerprints all over it. What we look at when we look in creation, we're looking into the mind of God. That's the way I like to look at it. And God has designed this world, so it's screaming at us, I'm here. This was intelligently designed. This is not by accident. And so we're going to look at some of those arguments this morning. I did start out an atheist. I already gave my testimony here. I did go through sciences. The Lord changed the direction of my life from science into ministry. I did get my PhD in microbiology, specializing in immunology and infectious diseases, which this past couple of years has been very appropriate. But anyway, a lot of fun. In the 1980s, when I was in the graduate department, it was the time to be in microbiology. It was a fantastic time. The AIDS virus, HIV, had come on the scene. We brought an end to the golden age of bacteriology that started in the 40s. We brought that in, to an end with Legionnaire's disease and the way we handled it. And then the AIDS virus kicked off the golden age of virology, which we're in right now and trying to get a handle on. And I am a creationist. Went from an atheist to a creationist. Boy, that was a big leap. Now, which came first? This is a really sort of a fun little question that gets asked, but it's really a profound question. And it really comes down to, did God create or did man create? That is, did God create creation, everything we see, and create man, or did man create God? Now, that comes out of Greek philosophy, where it's thought that really God is just a figment of man's imagination. That's why that question is there. That is a very real question. So the chicken or the egg question really is quite profound. It gets into the battle of worldviews that we're engaged in today. Science can actually answer that question. A lot of people don't realize that or don't think it's possible, but I'm going to show you how it is. Just a little background, so that as I'm speaking later about some of the laws, you'll understand the significance of it. The word science means knowledge, and what we're engaged in science is a quest for good knowledge, true knowledge. Decisions are only as good as the information that you have. Over the last several years, because of the way COVID has been treated, science has gotten a bad rap and got a bad name, but it's a method. The methodology of science is not the problem. It's the people who are driving that car. It's the guy behind that gun shooting, where he's pointing and shooting. You see, science itself isn't the problem. It's the worldview that's controlling the field of science right now. And that's good to keep in mind. We're not attacking science. All right, observation, interpretation, and experimentation. This is just these are the three steps that the scientific method involved. This is how discovery and understanding of our world comes to pass. We've got these little phones that are really powerful computers now that we carry around, put in our pocket. That's because of observation, interpretation, experimentation. Your cars that you drive and the machinery that you have out here, even the materials in this building, everything's the result of observation, experimentation, and observation, interpretation, experimentation. What we do in, the reason why that's important to know is because we're going to talk about laws of science. And I'm going to make a statement here that a lot of people struggle with, and that is science does not prove anything. Science can't prove anything, and scientists don't say that they can prove anything. In fact, what scientists say is, well, the preponderance of evidence, the results suggest, or strongly suggest. They use this kind of wording because there's always this thought, well, you'd have to be omniscient and infallible in your reasoning process and your technology and your equipment to really know for certain anything. You can't. So there's not a claim for proof, but the closest thing we have to proof is laws of science. As of today, there are no laws that exist that are refutable, and no reason to think that there are going to be exceptions or they're going to be refuted. Models. The way science works is they model. They create scenarios or hypotheses to explain our world. They don't have to be 100% accurate. This is how to understand what was going on in COVID. It was a big mess, and the way it was being presented really confused a lot of people. But the modeling, whether it be COVID, disease, vaccines, or whatever it might be, you don't have to be 100% correct. You have to have a working model to work with so that you can work on it and improve the explanation. And that is the process of science. So science really is a process. It's ongoing and always changing and acquiring new information and then tweaking your model to make it more accurate. So, when we're dealing with modeling or explanation of origins, like how did we get here, we need to have a model that explains the data. It's supported by data. If it's not, then we have to tweak that model. It doesn't contradict laws. Why is that? Because you go through the stepwise process. In science, you develop a hypothesis. It's not a guess. In elementary school, you're taught it's a guess. But a hypothesis has to be rooted in some precedents and a reason for why you're proposing an idea. You go to the laboratory, and you might find this. Let me tell a little story how this works. You get this brilliant idea. I think I know how something works. Well, I need to go test it. So you go in the laboratory. You go into your laboratory, and you're working on it. And here's what a scientist does. He tries to think about all the ways to prove it wrong. That sound funny? Yep. It's not because scientists are negative. That's how science works. You can't prove anything right. You can prove it if it's wrong. All I need is one piece of evidence, and that's wrong, so we have to move on. Now, by a process of elimination, if I can't find any reason to think, I knock out all the reasons that it might be wrong, guess what? It might be right.
Is that like the difference between inductive and deductive reasoning?
No, that's at the interpretation level. What you're doing, that's your reasoning process. Inductive is where you're implying. Deductive is where you're associating ideas. For example, inductive, you got the sun coming up every morning from the east, right? Well, we say it's coming up. It's really not coming up. We're rotating and spinning. But is it going to come up from the east tomorrow morning? That's inductive reasoning because it's always happened. It's implied that that's going to continue. Deductive would be A equals B, B equals C, therefore A equals C. That's the reasoning process there. Now, in hypothesizing, you do use inductive and deductive reasoning to derive your hypothesis. It's going to also be a part of your experimental process as well. So it's not just interpretation. But you'll have them both there. All right, so you go in the laboratory. You think about all the ways that how to prove your hypothesis wrong. Now, you got to do that because if you've got a credible hypothesis, you're going to put it out there in a peer-reviewed journal where everyone else in your field of specialty is going to read it. And you know what they're going to do? They're going to try and prove you wrong. That's how science works. So you want to make sure for the sake of saving face, right, that you have already thought as hard as you can, how can I prove this wrong? If you can't find any reason that it's wrong, and it seems to be always right, which means you can always make a prediction, you can predict discoveries, behavior, whatever. Every time you stand in front of a moving car, the car is always going to run over you. You know, you can make predictions because of certain laws that exist. So what happens here is you publish your results, and then your peers look at it, and they go in the laboratory and try and prove it wrong, and they can't prove you wrong. You might be right. You might have something there. So then you have a theory. A theory is stronger than a hypothesis because now you've got others who are supporting your research and they can't find anything wrong with it. And then for thousands of experiments, many years, that continues on. There's no known exceptions and no reason to think there'll be exceptions. It's always predictable. Hey, you got a law. So I'm just showing you how laws graduate in strength there, that hey, this might be the correct way to think about something. So a credible model must not violate, number three, does not contradict laws of science. If it does, then it's clearly an incredible model. It has no legitimacy whatsoever. Now, let me make this point. Just because it does contradict the law, it doesn't mean you can't take it in the laboratory and try to prove it wrong. That's why we've got quantum mechanics today, and we've got other fields of science, because someone went in and continued to challenge the laws or what they thought were facts of the day. And so everything, even a law of science, is up for grabs to be tested. Now, past events of origins were not directly observed. It's the same with everybody, whether we're talking about the creation science or the evolution model. No one was there except for God, and we have His word on it. Origin events can't be repeated in the laboratory, and I'm going to show you a statement by an evolutionist to that fact, which is nice that they admit it. Therefore, models of origins will never become scientific laws. Why? Because you cannot sufficiently prove that they're wrong because no one was there and you can't test it in the laboratory. But you can look for evidence to support it. But you're not going to recreate the creation event. You're not going to recreate the Big Bang. It's just not going to happen. So you look for evidence for it. Here we have René Debeco, a Nobel Prize winner, said the evolutionary events that took place over a period of many thousands of years, well, they're into millions, cannot be reproduced in the laboratory. What is that? Well, that's an admission. They don't have the evidence to demonstrate that that could actually happen. So what are they looking for? They're looking for circumstantial evidence just to put together in their story. Now, we'll learn more about that this afternoon as well. Now, here's what happens when you have a bias in science, which is going to ruin your modeling, your hypothesizing. Evolution excludes supernatural regardless of the evidence, and it forces facts to fit into your conclusion. When I was a grad student, I had six months to go on my dissertation, defend my work, and that's when they really started cranking up the pressure on me because I was a creation scientist in the Department of Microbiology at the University of Arkansas here. I was called in. There was a campaign to kick me out. They put two stipulations on me after a meeting. I was sitting there at the round table, and all the faculty were there asking me questions about origins, what science is and what it isn't, what it can and can't say, et cetera, et cetera. And then they put me outside in the hall and said, we're going to vote. And Dr. Paulson, who was my mentor, took me down to the office and said, well, I want to let you know, it was not a unanimous decision to keep you here in the department. But everyone agrees you have to abide by two stipulations. Number one, you have to agree to stop writing articles in the newspaper about creation science. Because I had started the Creation Science Society on campus, try to bolster that and help that the community of grad students in particular who were creationists. We'd bring speakers in to the university and sponsor them, and we had Dr. Gish, we had Governor White, we had all kinds of people coming in and speaking, Dr. Blick from Oklahoma at the university there. The second stipulation they put on me was you have to take another class in evolution. So when I went to class, it turned out to be me. They set up the entire semester class just for me, with me, myself, and I. And the professor set it up, so we met every Friday, give me a stack of materials to read. It was just some mathematical modeling for distribution of genes in a population, population genetics. It wasn't anything controversial at all. He was surprised. He gave me a good write-up. He said, you really understand evolution better than the faculty around here. That's what he said. He said, I'm not going to write that down in your report. But he said, I've never had a student start out so knowledgeable about evolution. I said, well, Dr. Carr, you know, I was an evolutionist. I've rejected it. I had to look through this and work through this process. So for that, he said that I demonstrated superior knowledge above and beyond my peers, and he gave me a B for the class. Yeah, that's how that works in academia. I didn't agree. I understood, but I didn't agree, and so that knocked my grade down. See, that's bias. That's a bias, too. But one of the points I made during our meetings was that, Dr. Carr, I'm a better scientist than you are. And the reason for that is my mind is open to entertain all explanations, to follow the data wherever it leads and not force it into this box it doesn't want to fit in, the naturalism or the physical box, that only natural explanations can be entertained, and you have to exclude information or exclude the direction that evidence is pointing you to. You cannot, you're arbitrarily prejudiced against considering supernatural explanations. That doesn't work. So anyway, he enjoyed the class. We had great discussions, and he said, I'm surprised you're so open-minded. I said, the only reason why you say that is because you're listening to the critics. A creationist does not argue against mutation or natural selection. That's not our argument. It's an argument of limited change versus unlimited change. So anyway, we had a great time there. Here's the evidences that we'll start into today. Intelligent design, first law of thermodynamics, second law of thermodynamics, and then law of biogenesis, law of probabilities, and you're saying, laws? See, that's why I told you about those laws. The laws of science are the closest thing we have to proof. As of today, they're irrefutable and no reason to think that they're ever going to be different. So a credible model has to be conformed to and in support of the known laws that exist. Then we got laboratory research, and we're not going to get into that. I'll just show you a chart. Speciation research and fossil record is what we'll be looking at for the supernatural argument for speciation. Getting into the design arguments, Charles Saxon, who was at the university at Prague at the time, he makes a good point in an article, and that is when you're looking at for design, it's reasonable to imagine that you're going to be able to distinguish design elements from accidental elements. When you go out to the river out here and you're finding arrowheads, you can tell. Now that was design. There was an intelligent effort here to make this arrowhead as opposed to, oh, water did that and it was chipped and formed that arrowhead. It doesn't work that way. So we can recognize design in our world. Why is that important? Anybody have an idea why that might be important? It's because the evolutionists argue that, well, you're involving God and using him as an explanation, and that's unscientific. You can't put God in a test tube and make that happen. Well, That's rather hypocritical, because what are we doing in the scientific world right now in astronomy? We're in the search for extraterrestrial life. Somewhere out in the outer space, and we've got the SETI program, we've got the optical SETI program, we're sending signals out into outer space, and we've got our antennas set up scouring outer space for signals. And what is the premise there? What justifies the millions and millions of dollars spent to send signals into space and to look for signals? Well, the justification is we're going to recognize the difference between accidental or haphazard radiation just coming from suns and stars, as opposed to a design signal that's going to have regular patterns and show intelligent design. Now wait, did you just say that you can recognize intelligent design from haphazard or accidental events? Yeah, that's exactly what the evolutionists are doing. However, you can't apply that to creation science, because that would involve God. Hey, well, remove God out of the picture. Are we talking about intelligent design? Is there evidence for intelligent design? I think there is. Look at this. This is called the DNA code. Now, what's going on in outer space with the SETI program? We're sending out... We're sending out these patterns, this message, this code. It means something, right? Information is designed, it's intelligent, it's created. Well, that's what we're looking for, so we can recognize intelligent design signals coming from outer space. And the premise is smart people, smart creatures out there in outer space, which they think exists, it doesn't. But we're sending signals with the idea that if they're smart, they're going to recognize this is intelligently designed, because there's information in this code. Well, here we are, each one of us, we've got information code, it's called the DNA molecule, built right into our bodies. And we've got four letters here, A, T, C, and G, and they're read in triplet code, and all that you are in your body, from your eyes and the ability to see, and then your brain to think and assimilate and understand the world around you, all of that is remarkably coded and given meaning in this DNA molecule. The coded information in the nucleus of one cell is equal to 1 million pages in an encyclopedia. Now you've got this signal. I put the signal here. Or it's God is sending us a signal. Hey, intelligent design, intelligent design. Here we are scouring the universe, the space, looking for a signal, and here it is, right here in each one of our cells in the body. And you compare the signal that we're looking for in outer space with the signal that's coming out of our DNA molecule, the complexity, the information is not even comparable. We're just in the slightest degree of design in a radio signal coming from outer space, we're going to say, ah, there's intelligent design. Look at that. It's right there in our DNA molecule. Now, when we're talking about the genome, in 2000, there was this big race to get the human DNA code fully understood, break the code. And what that means is, I'll go back to 1960s, there was the move in the 1960s proposal that we're going to map out the human genome. Now that is a tall order, especially back, I mean that just was thought to be impossible. But they charted this out, and by 2050, they were going to have the gene mapped out, the gene map made for the human DNA. Just the gene. Well, with the advancement of computer technology, it went way beyond the genetic map. It got into the code of each gene. So we're talking about millions and millions of nucleotides that these codes, these A, G, the adenine, guanine, thymine, cytosine sequences, all of these chemical codes, by the year 2000, they were cracking the code. And then you had private and governmental industries, they were racing and see who could come up first and grab the fame and fortune for being the first ones to crack the code. Well, it didn't really wasn't a first who came in first. The speed at which that happened was so great. It was really sloppy work, but the human genome was cracked by the year 2000. Shaved off 50 years for the gene map, and then who knows how many years, they didn't even project, for the actual code of each gene. Did that make sense to you guys? Sometimes I get into that. It's exciting to when you start thinking about what's really going on. It's phenomenal. But after 2000, the ENCODE program started. And I'll just mention that ENCODE dumped the human DNA, which James Watson of the famed Watson and Crick couple, James Watson was the one chosen to have his DNA code dumped into the database online. You can find it in ENCODE. And then amateurs, as well as scientists, everyone could jump on board and try to put this big, massive puzzle of code and protein output and a transcription translation type process going on. It's huge. So by dumping it into the internet, they could get hundreds of thousands of people working on assimilating and making sense out of this code. Now, if some of you remember it, they thought, boy, there's a lot of junk DNA. This doesn't make sense at all. There's only, well, they went from 300 million genes to 30 million genes, and then they discovered, wow, there's really not that many genes involved in the human genome. And the reason for that is switches and mechanisms and master switches that would turn on and turn off like a computer code. You got subroutines. Let me give you an example. If I've got 6 subroutines and they're always producing the same output, I can mix and match those and have the same operation. Well, that's probably confusing. Yes? That it hasn't changed?
Yes.
Well, you would think that it was. Are you saying that it should have been changed? Natural selection is what it is. That would be their answer, that has been preserved. We do have the same code that exists among all organisms, whether you're talking about a fungus, a bacteria, a tree, a jellyfish, humans. It's a phenomenon. It's a beautiful design that God put into us. When you have a mechanism or a code that works, how can you improve on it? Well, God, you can take, for example, the code for glow-in-the-dark protein. You can take that code out of the jellyfish, put it in a human, you got a glow-in-the-dark human. And they did that with glow-in-the-dark pigs. They got glow-in-the-dark mice now, glow-in-the-dark snakes, glow-in-the-dark, pigs, mice, cats, snakes. You probably got more now. But there isn't an argument necessarily for or against. They would just say that was selective pressures and it preserved that which works. For the creationists, they would say, well, that was a perfect design. How can you improve on the design, ATGC? Not only that, but we all organisms draw on the same energy source, same food. If you eat the same food, then you ought to have the same mechanisms for processing it. Why create a different mechanism? Why not use the best mechanism for processing food and extracting energy, right? And so you got your basic macromolecules of your nucleic acids, your fats, your lipids, and your proteins. They're all made of the same stuff. And they're all coded by the same code because they're all processing the same food resource.
So would you say that the difference between inanimate matter and living organisms is the DNA?
That is a difference. There's no doubt. There is a difference there. But what makes something living? Well, you can have a DNA molecule. You can make it in the laboratory and it's not alive. What makes something alive is that membrane. It's a functional membrane. When you get into what evolutionists are creating now, prototypes. Prototypes are trying to simulate membrane. But those membranes are not able to sustain life. And the reason for that is the membrane is very complex and is fighting against osmotic pressure. That's water going in or water going out across the membrane. You got to have a salt pump. It's a sodium pump. And by controlling the salt on either side of the membrane, you're trying to maintain water pressure in your cells. If that pump is not working and water keeps flooding into your cell, well, that's like a balloon. I use balloons and fruit cocktail jello as an example. Think about a cell. You got a balloon, you fill it up with jello and fruit cocktail. There's all your little organelles in there in this medium we call cytoplasm. And you've got this balloon. If you keep pumping water in there, pretty soon it's going to go vroom, pop. That's what happens when you go into the hospital and they put an IV in you. They're not pumping pure water into your blood. They'd be popping all your blood cells for that reason. They got to maintain a saline solution so that there's balance going on. Going back to your question, life really is defined by this functional membrane, and that's something that happened in the Garden of Eden when God breathed the breath of life into Adam. All of a sudden, everything kicked in. Yes. Well, what I'm saying is that as far as us, when God breathed the breath of life, but everything has to have a functional cell membrane. Every living thing has a functional cell membrane. If it doesn't have a membrane, it's not alive. Viruses are not alive. They're not considered alive. They're viable. They have to be able to come into contact with a living thing in order to multiply themselves. So they have to be able to attach to a membrane, squirt in their DNA, and then hijack the mechanism, which some of you may have learned about during COVID. And then you have hijack your cells to convert it into a virus production plant. And now you're producing all these viruses because it found a functional membrane. Same way with prions. Prions are just molecules that can do the same thing, but they only multiply because they can attach themselves to a living cell and hijack the DNA. Yeah.
So the evolution of stars that are studied in the universe, how would you explain it to stopping the fact that it started with whatever?
Very good question, because what makes it stop? I mean, here we are at the top. We're at the apex of that it's called the phylogenetic tree. Well, we haven't stopped. We just don't know what's coming because it hasn't come yet. But man is evolving. If you listen to Elon Musk, the human population right now is evolving into AI. That's where we're headed.
Well, I understand that we're evolving as ideals. And we're going to keep thinking of it.
Yep.
Or
Okay, among any organisms, not necessarily because of selection pressure. Selection pressures define what you're actually going to see, and for evolution, because it's all accidental, this is called tautological argument, circular reasoning. Why are we here? Because we were fit enough. How do we know we were fit enough? Because we're here. Why are we here? Because we're fit enough. So you have this circular reasoning. It doesn't resolve itself.
Yeah.
Lizards and tortoises and birds, finches, all kinds of stuff. Yes, those are adaptations. The finches are still finches. The tortoises are still tortoises. These animals are still the same. And this gets into the distinction with speciation, that the creation model proposes that that change is limited within a boundary of a kind, identifiable genetic kind, whereas the evolutionists say you have vertical change or unlimited change without end. Now, what is the evidence for that? Well, when you go in the laboratory, the hallmark organism for that is Drosophila melanogaster, which, wow, big name for that little pesky fruit fly flying around. But that it has big genes, four big chromosomes, excellent for genetic studies. And they have bombarded that little creature, which PETA did not mind. But you can do whatever you want to that fruit fly. They radiated, accelerated the mutational events. Millions of generations of flies. In the 1990s, they finally concluded, that fruit fly is still a fruit fly and always will be a fruit fly, because it's at the dead end of the phylogenetic branch. For its branch, how do you know it's at the dead end? Because it's not changing. Why isn't it changing? It's at the dead end. How do you know it's at the dead end? Because it's not changing. So, see, again, it does not resolve itself. It's a story, a narrative that all they need is, I can explain it. It's a story. Doesn't matter what the fallacy is. I feel good about it. It's a fact. Which brings up one more, and I'm getting to you. I haven't forgotten you. Which brings up one more important thing, and that is when we're talking about the fact of evolution, two things are going on. They have two different definitions of evolution. And one is, hey, if you look at Webster's Dictionary, definition one, change. Don't you believe things change? Dr. Kramer challenged me on that in 1981. I was setting up a debate between her and Gish, and she said, debates are unethical. And then she said, don't you believe that organisms change? And I said, well, sure they change. She said, that's all evolution is. I said, Dr. Kramer, you know, if we went out and interviewed any student on the sidewalk and said, what is evolution? They're not going to say change. They're going to give you the general theory of evolution. You see, so this is a play on words, and they switch up depending on what's to their advantage in a debate or in a discussion. They're going to say, it just means change. Oh, it means much more than that. And that's what they mean when they say evolution is a fact. What they're saying is change is a fact. But then they give you the unfactual story of the general theory of evolution. So it's switch and bait going on there, and that doesn't work. The other thing is they're changing. Remember I talked about hypothesis, theory, and law? Well, they're changing the definition of law in the public textbooks. Theory is essentially a law. Why? Because origin models will never become a law unless you change the definition. So now they're blending theory and law together in the textbooks so that kids can be told that evolution is a fact, because theory is essentially a fact. And that's a travesty talk about dangerous in the educational system, teaching people just propaganda rather than educating them. What was your question?
He was asking why evolution gets stopped with us, and I just wanted to posit that there was a Western human on some island, I forget exactly where it was, who had a rather large pancreas, which allowed them to hold their breath for a much longer time underwater, because they died to go fishing.
Right. Well, you have adaptation and all kinds. Part of our design in the DNA molecule is to create a lot of variety. You look in the room here, there's a lot of variety in the human population. We all came from Adam. But if you look at the whole world population, man, we got tremendous variation that occurs in the human population. So you're going to see that. In fact, in the medical health side of this is to study what they call superhumans. For example, if you can hold your breath longer, you can walk through icy waters or snow trails for long periods of time and not suffer from hypothermia. You can see better. The study right now with the superhumans is to identify the genes and proteins that are involved in giving those qualities. You develop a library of all these genes, and where that's headed in the future is, hey, you can pick and select different genes and actually modify a DNA, a genome, and put those collection of superhuman genes into an individual, and they'll have all those qualities. They're thinking that might be the way of evolution of humanity as well, or any type. You can do it with any organism. Going back to your question earlier with regard to this, the way God designed everything, because of the same food source requires the same mechanisms to break it down, going through glycolysis and what they call Krebs cycle and the hydrogen transport chain. This is extracting all of this information, or all of this energy out of food, and then being able to convert it through all these biological pathways. All of this is controlled by a code. That's why the code is the same for all living organisms. It's by design. It's the best code for processing all foods. You can go to North Carolina Biological Supplies or some other gene labs. You can order genes like you would for car parts. I used to have an old 66 GMC, and it had parts that could be swapped out with a Ford. Well, I'd go down to Napa and get parts for the truck. It didn't matter whether it was Ford or GMC, or sometimes other parts can be swapped. I can swap parts in. You can do that with DNA as well. You can order the glow-in-the-dark protein gene that was captured from jellyfish and then splice that into humans. It's possible to do that. Now, back in 1983, I took the first molecular cloning class at the University of Arkansas. Dr. Tim Krall was just starting. He hadn't taken the class before. So this was something all the grad students and Dr. Krall, we all went through the learning process ourselves. I would call that cloning process, it was molecular cloning, not cloning animals or anything. I would call that, it was very primitive. It's like beating DNA with a stick. And you didn't know what was going to happen, and we marked DNA with antibiotic markers attached to it so that we, after chopping them up, throw them in a petri dish, see what grew. And if it grew, we knew that those organisms had actually acquired the ability to resist antibiotic, that particular antibiotic. The point I'm making is, now, today, you've got restrictive enzymes. It's like surgical precision. You can slice a gene right out of a DNA and put a replacement gene in it. That's where we are in our technology today. So you can actually create an entire genome for an organism. They got the word bacteria syncytium comes to mind. They've got an organism that has viability, it's alive, but the entire genome was created in the laboratory and placed into its nucleus. And that was based on knowing what the code is of a previous organism. Then they followed that pattern and created the DNA molecule in the lab, and then they popped it into the nucleus of another organism, and sure enough, it lived. So there's a lot of research going on in how far can we take this. But it's just, I think of it as computers. A cell is a very, very sophisticated, intelligently designed computer, which goes back to the whole point of intelligent design. Who wrote these computer programs anyway? Did it just happen by chance out of thin air? And here we are, we've got this program code we call DNA. We can go in and modify it, change the code. You got viruses that can infect and change the code. You got people that can go in and change the code. You got subroutines, master genes, switches of all kinds, all that junk DNA I was talking about. Most of the DNA that is in our human, in our cells, most of that DNA is what was I going to say about that? Most of that DNA is usable in DNA. It's not junk after all. It's beautifully designed. You got a hierarchy of switches in the DNA where you've got like the eye. You got many genes controlling the eye. Let me just jump forward here. So here you got all different parts to the eye. There's a lot that goes into it. From the tissues to the vascularization of the eye to the lens to the cornea, everything about it to the iris, it just goes on and on and on. There is a gene or a set of genes, more than one gene, controlling all those different parts. A master switch has to be calling on all those different genes and making sense out of it so it can produce a single eye. It's remarkable. When you look at this thing, you can't help but say, man, that didn't happen by accident. The brain, even more complex, they're still working on mapping. And the brain is so complex that now they have to, the brain's been divided up and everyone's working on their own parts right now, mapping it out, and someday they'll have enough information. They're going to have someone put it all together, all those parts. I think this is incredible. We're talking about the eye, single eye. But why are there two eyes? And why are they right there? Why isn't there one here, and one here, so you can see this way and that way? I mean, why not that? That seems like that would be evolutionarily beneficial. Yeah, I can see it. Why not four eyes? Why is it two legs? Yeah, there's this body symmetry is not by accident. Accident, you would expect like a mud pie. It's a blob. It has no design. There's no symmetry in accidents. You don't see it happening. And yet here we see symmetry. I like this example where scientists actually go and look at what God's created to find out how to make their machines better. Whether it's airplanes or boats or whatnot, they're going to God. Not unwittingly, you know, as the Bible would say. They're going to God to find out how to make things better. You got instinct behaviors that are just incredible. What about this Arctic tern the adults, the parents take off before the hatchlings are fully developed, and then they get all the food resource. Somehow they know to get plenty of food, just enough to fly from Alaska to Hawaii over ocean waters that where there's no landmarks, no nothing, and yet. It's like getting that basketball into a basket. I mean, you can't go this way or that way. You can't go too far. I mean, when you think about the logistics of just hitting that, why do those birds still exist? My favorite example for design arguments is the bombardier beetle, because I like to talk about this critter because it's got two little chemical sacs in its abdomen at the back, and when a predator comes, it squirts it out, and those two chemicals form together in midair, react, form hot hydrochloric acid because it's an exothermic reaction, splashes their enemy, and it's hot acid is what they're faced with. Now, can you imagine the evolution of such a critter? Can you imagine the accidents that it had to go through? Blowing its rear end off every time it makes a mistake. How do you have another generation? How do you get through all the mistakes so now you got a bombardier beetle that can be expert at throwing hot acid at it? When you look at the complexity of the cell, it's more complex than a city. I mean, there's a diagram of the city in there. It's far more complex. Machineries. This is a flagella. This is a little motor that's embedded in the membrane. We'll talk about the membrane. I talked about the sodium pump, but man, there's all kinds of things embedded into this cell membrane that makes it functional. It's amazing. But when you start getting into it, when you start getting into looking at design built into our bodies, into life, into the universe, and I'll pick up where we left off here on this fine-tuned argument, it's absolutely overwhelming and phenomenal, the intelligent design, the creation that has been formed around us. God has God's intelligence and fingerprints all over it. There's no way it could happen by accident. I'll show you why in the next segment when we talk about the laws of thermodynamics and probabilities to just blow you away. All right.
To me, I'm very simple-minded, so I look at this table right here, this communion table. You're never going to convince me that that disappears. You're just not going to do it. You can say, well, where did this wind come from? Where the sand, or the wood, where all these products come from, are they eternal? And then over a million years, well, that's what happened. I'm not going to believe that. And when you look at the complexity of the eye and the universe, we can see that there's much intelligent design. It's the only thing to me that makes sense. So we're going to take a break. We're going to be back here in probably about an hour, 20 minutes. We'll keep forth at about 1:30, and we'll have our last class for the day. If you have any questions during the time of food and fellowship, the pastor's going to be there. And I'm